Welcome to the Diggin' Oak Island Podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and I thank you for downloading and listening. Since the moment that Daniel McGinnis laid eyes on a strange depression in the ground on Oak Island, people theorized that it might be the home of a pirate treasure. In fact, for probably the better part of a century, the Oak Island money pit was often just assumed to be the hiding place of Captain Kidd's lost treasure. Over the years, we've gotten away from pirate theories a bit, but it's still a subject often discussed when theorizing the origin of the Oak Island mystery. But are pirates really possible culprits in all this? In order to answer that, I thought the first step should be to acquire a little knowledge about pirate activity throughout Atlantic Canada during the years before the 19th century. So to help us do that, I have asked Dan Conlon to join us and talk some pirate history. Now, before we get into the interview, I just want to point out one thing. The sound is good, not great. I was having some issues with the echoing going on. That mostly due to the international call I'm making here. I'm not in Canada. But I think the information in there is terrific, and Mr. Conlon gives us a lot to think about. So I excuse the audio. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, talk to Mr. Conlon, and then when the interview's over, we'll take another quick break and we'll discuss it a little bit more. Mr. Conlon is a historian who teaches a course on myth and realities of piracy at St. Mary's University in Halifax and is the author of the book Pirates of the Atlantic: Robbery, Murder, and Mayhem off Canada's East Coast. Mr. Conlon, thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay, so where I would like to begin is kind of with a basic overview of the time frames that saw the most pirate activity in the area, in the broader Atlantic Canada area. Oak Island is such a small area, such a small island. So I wanted to sort of get us an overview of when the most pirate activity was happening in and around here.
There are two big bursts of piracy in Atlantic Canada. The first is in the early 1600s, mainly centered in Newfoundland along the Grand Banks. And then the second is in the early 1700s, which is sort of broader across the entire region, the so-called Golden Age of piracy, when there's an enormous burst of piracy all over the North Atlantic, but much of it takes place in Atlantic Canada. And those are sort of the two main periods where you see the big names and the most intense activity of piracy.
So by big names, are we talking about sort of a who's who, a hall of fame, so to speak, of the legendary pirates of of lore?
Yeah, when we think of piracy today, and people, we think of people with cutlasses and tricorn hats and big names like Blackbeard and Captain Kidd, that's really drawn from the Golden Age piracy in the early 1700s. There was an explosion in not only piracy, but also writing of boat pirates in that period with some notable books and also extensive newspaper coverage in the colonial newspapers. And that's when the sort of the deep romance of what was a very uncontrolled and frightening burst of piracy is kind of created, and it's inspired authors, playwrights, and movie makers ever since. There is this earlier burst of piracy in the early 1600s when the Grand Banks fishery off of Newfoundland becomes an enormous international enterprise and attacks pirates. And there's some at their time, big names like Peter Easton. At one point, got between 500 and 1,500 men under his command. And so there's that earlier intense burst of piracy in the region. After the 1700s, really piracy becomes very rare in Atlantic Canada, becomes kind of a once a generation, much talked about event. But it's these two early periods that kind of produce some very interesting history, as well as all kinds of myths and legends.
You touched on a couple of things there I'd like to get back to, including Peter Easton. But before we do that, when people think of pirates, they think of the Caribbean and maybe of the Indian Ocean, Madagascar. But it certainly seems, just from short research, that Atlantic Canada had quite a bit of pirate activity. And I'm wondering why that might be. Maybe you touched on it a bit with the Atlantic fisheries. But, I'll talk about that a little bit more. I mean, for one thing, there's no gold there.
No.
You know?
But there are thousands and thousands of sailors working in the fishery, many of them really unhappy, and they are excellent recruits for pirates. So Atlantic Canada sort of functions in this international network of sort of pirate hunting grounds. It was actually known in the era as the Pirate Round, and there were four main areas. There was the Caribbean, sort of most familiar to people, all those isolated islands in rich trade between South America and North America around the West Indies. But then also West Africa, the enormous slave trade there, which attracted a lot of the pirate attacks. The Indian Ocean, early outbreak of piracy there with all the rich trade across the Indian Ocean. And then the fourth area is Atlantic Canada, and enormous international fishery centered in the Grand Banks with every country in Europe sending thousands of fishermen over there seasonally. Not lots of gold, but lots of ships, big and small, lots of supplies, and most importantly for pirates, lots of recruits. So you see these seasonal movement of pirates. They will just sort of do lots of raids in West Africa and the Caribbean. But then frequently, and sometimes with astonishing regularity, come May or June, they sail north up the coast of America, and then arriving in Newfoundland when the international fishery is arriving to raid fishing ships, recruit people, tackle transatlantic trade, and then come September, head back down south again. you see this kind of regular orbit of pirate ships. So the Atlantic region kind of attracts some of the biggest and most vicious pirates in the golden age of piracy, kind of make these regular seasonal raids.
I would imagine chasing the good weather might have something to do with that as well.
Well, yeah, escaping the worst of the heat in the West Indies, but also it's just there's this enormous seasonal flow of poorly defended fishing fleets from Europe that kind of make very attractive targets for pirates, and then of course they're fleeing the not only the colder weather in the fall but also the seasonal hurricanes that start to track up in September. And it's kind of interesting. Once the British and French navies get serious about piracy in the 1720s, they kind of figure this out, and they position patrol and escort bases, and they crush the golden age of piracy in the sort of the mid 1720s fairly effectively once they kind of mobilize some state naval protection.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that in this early colonial period, we don't really have anything that we would now sort of refer to as law enforcement or something like that that's helping protect these fleets from pirates, correct?
Absolutely. And that's why in the early 1600s, that huge international fishery off the coast of Newfoundland attracts a lot of pirates because there are no naval squadrons, there are no navy bases, there are no forts. It's just all individual merchants who are responsible for their own fishing plantation operations and defending their own vessels, and they're often rivals with each other. And it's really a free for all,
right?
and that attracts all kinds of raiding between rival fishing fleets, but frequently these pirates who kind of attack them. Most people don't realize it's really not until the 1700s that British and French navies actually start to send the occasional naval ship to North American waters, and they don't actually base squadrons here until much later. So that makes lots of opportunities for pirates.
Okay, so I want to go back to somebody who you already mentioned, and that is Peter Easton. I mean, this is an incredible guy. All you have to do really is read a Wikipedia page on him, and you can't believe what you're reading. This is a guy who had a huge fleet. He was never caught. There's no story of him being captured by somebody. He wasn't caught by the British Navy or hung or anything like that. He was very, very successful. And he kind of, his waters were mostly what we would call Newfoundland or Labrador coast. But I would imagine that's pretty close to Nova Scotia or to this area. So I would imagine sort of Atlantic Canada was really sort of his territory.
Well, he certainly does focus his activities in Newfoundland, and the fishery had not really spread south or up the St. Lawrence River or down south to Nova Scotia and New Brunswick at that point. It was really focused on those really rich fishing grounds just off the coast of Newfoundland, and that's what attracts Peter Easton in 1610. He had been a privateer, that's sort of a licensed raider for the crown against the French and Spanish in wars, but when peace breaks out, he decides to just keep raiding. And so he sort of goes from legal privateer to illegal pirate in the channel. And when things get hot there, he moves to other waters and arrives in Newfoundland about 1610. And very rapidly builds up a huge fleet, setting up a base in Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, building a house and a palisade fort ashore, and capturing ships, then summoning help from British fishing ships with sort of the message, you send me your carpenters and I won't rob you. And he builds this enormous fleet of men, estimated between 500 and 1,500, raiding ships of all nations, and using Newfoundland as a base to make forays kind of further south to raid Spanish treasure fleets. And, you know, the size of his operation at this period is quite remarkable. I mean, it's the only colony in British at this point in Newfoundland is like 40 men, and they've got five cannons. And here's this pirate with over 500 men and a whole fleet of vessels.
Wow.
So he's a really remarkable fellow. We've got some great eyewitness accounts. He captures one merchant named Richard Whitborn, who has fascinating discussions with Easton about the morality of piracy, and Easton tries to seduce Whitborn into sort of joining his encounters, and then eventually releases Whitborn and sends him off with a request to get a pardon from the English king. But then Easton, with great flair, according to the accounts of the day, says that he doesn't want a pardon because, in his words, in many ways, I am a king myself. And eventually leaves Newfoundland about 1613 and sort of shifts to the Mediterranean, and then retires to great wealth and safety in the south of France.
I mean, great wealth and safety. This guy was living the dream.
Yeah, he's one of the very few North Atlantic pirates that actually kind of, you know, do acquire that wealth and sort of die in comfort in their own bed. Most of the pirates meet nasty ends. But he's in that early period, you know, where there's this kind of gray zone between privateering and piracy and very little crown enforcement. And if one gets wealth, you can kind of buy safety and security by, say, a duke in the south of France. And Easton is kind of a real kind of king of that era.
Now, you did mention the word privateering. I thought if you can maybe discuss the differences between privateering and piracy, because those two seem to be often used in conjunction with each other, and there certainly seems to be a slippery slope that goes from privateer to pirate.
Yes, particularly in our early years. So privateering privateers are privately owned ships that have a license from the crown to attack enemy ships, and only in times of war. And there's a system of regulation to sort of keep their raiding sort of somewhat orderly. And very common prior to the the mid-18th century, state navies are actually quite small. And they and when war is declared, the king sort of, you know, is quite keen to enlist private ships to join his cause, and will license them with these letters of marque that's supposed to limit their raiding to enemy ships, not neutral or friendly ships. And so it's long-established practice. In the 1600s, early 1700s, it was not very well regulated. And in that early period, privateers, you know, often drifted from privateering to piracy. When the war stopped, they kept raiding. And that was kind of a real problem for European leaders. The government started to sort of get more serious about the regulations in the early 1700s. And Captain Kidd is a good example of a fellow who went from privateering to piracy, and then the crown decided to make an example of him, and they start to stiffen up in the rules. By the mid to late 18th century, there's a very clear distinction with very serious enforcement by the government about privateers who turn bad. But in that early period, there's quite a bit of back and forth. The two of them sort of exist in a similar orbit of loot. Not to be forgotten, though, is Navy ships in this period also get to keep what they capture. So naval captains can be just as greedy and sometimes just as unscrupulous about raiding ships. So the three of them all have in this common fighting on the ocean to enrich themselves with varying degrees of regulation, running from nothing for pirates to some to privateers to more serious regulations for naval ships.
Well, since you mentioned Captain Kidd, you know, his name is the name most associated with Oak Island. We've named, you know, there are others, William Phipps, Henry Morgan. We already mentioned Peter Easton. But really, since the first time anybody put a shovel into the ground in search of a treasure on Oak Island, it seems that Captain Kidd's name has come up. But where does this really really come from other than some apocryphal tales? I mean, did he ever sail to Nova Scotia? Does he have a history in Atlantic Canada?
Well, he does, and he has an enormous influence on our perception of pirate treasure. You can blame William Kidd and Robert Louis Stevenson for almost every notion you have about pirate treasure. And, you know, in historical fact, pirates did not bury treasure. They were very serious about what they captured, and they most of them knew that they weren't going to be free and healthy for very long, so they had very specific rules about how they split their money up and they spent it as quickly as possible. So we have virtually no historical examples of pirates ever burying treasure. It's not how they operated. And so the notion that they would bury treasure in some place like Oak Island in terms of the history of piracy is ludicrous. But Captain Kidd is a really interesting introduction to how this treasure becomes associated with pirates. He was a privateer, you know, a legally licensed attacker of French ships and in the 1600s in the wars with France, and quite successful, based out of New York, and quite well respected. So when the British are dealing with an outbreak of piracy in the Indian Ocean in the late 1600s, they decide, well, we'll recruit this colonial privateer, William Kidd from New York, we'll outfit him with a custom ship, we'll get these investors, and in a private-public partnership, we'll send him off to the Indian Ocean to scrub out piracy there, the investors will get rich, the crown will sort of secure sea lanes. And so he sets off to the Indian Ocean, and then everything goes wrong. And depending on who you believe, he either was forced by his crew to turn to piracy or he turned to piracy himself and starts attacking everybody's ships in the Indian Ocean, friendlies, allied, and neutral, and then returns to New York expecting he can buy himself out of trouble like so many other privateers had done in the past.
Right.
But when he returns to New York and he goes straight back to New York, he doesn't detour to Nova Scotia, he expects the governor there will sort of, cut him a deal. But there was a brand new governor who was a law and order type, and Kidd had really embarrassed his investors in London by causing all kinds of trouble and complaints in the Indian Ocean. So they make an example of him. And he had hid his treasure with various friends in the New York area. He didn't bury it. He kind of hid it with various merchant friends. And then the crown says, well, where's your money? And he says, okay, I hid it with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And they round up all that treasure. And he's hoping that he will then be issued a pardon, but they decide to send him to trial. And at that point, he then creates a sort of 300 years of treasure hunting by saying, oh, but there's more. You know, I hid some more treasure, and if you'll just let me go, I'll tell you where it is. And that has planted the seeds of centuries of treasure hunting about, well, where did he hide it? You know,
right.
How much extra is there? So this was kind of the bargaining of a desperate man who eventually goes on trial and is executed for piracy. And so that has created this endless speculation about where was his extra treasure that, you know, most of us kind of feel that was, you know, that was just a fiction by a man looking at the gallows. So he's the first person when people start to notice some sinkholes on Oak Island in the 1790s, which is settled farmland by then. They see some sinkholes and they start to dig and they find a few logs, and that immediately they think it has to be Captain Kidd or Blackbeard, the two big pirate names everybody
right.
knows. And so, and then the theories just spin out from one pirate to one expedition to one fantasy after another. You can kind of blame Captain Kidd's sort of desperate lying as he was facing a piracy trial for that obsession with his treasure being everywhere, but particularly Oak Island.
Well, now there's, one of the things I was going to ask you, you mentioned there about the pirates not burying treasure, and we have all these sort of examples from the Caribbean or from Gardner's Island of ideas of burying treasure. And one of the things that you talk about in your course, one of the parts of your course, is the myths of piracy. And it seems to me that Oak Island kind of brings all the myths and the legends together, and you have the cursed treasure and the buried treasure, and you have strange phenomenon and all these kind of things. And I guess the question is, you know, is this all, do we have Captain Kidd and Robert Louis Stevenson to just the only them to blame for all of this? Or is the idea of buried treasure and these kind of things something that permeates throughout the history of piracy?
Yeah, so what you see with that pervasive myth, of pirate treasure is the confluence of two things. One is there is a long and really interesting sort of folklore tradition that pirates buried treasure and they protected it with kind of magic curses, and that there's rules that treasure hunters have to follow to find those treasures. And these kind of legends, they probably connect to some ancient Celtic legends about to bury fairy gold. But they were documented by folklorists in the early 20th century across Nova Scotia and other parts of the Maritimes and Newfoundland. And everybody would point to a local island and say, pirates buried treasure there, but they also buried a sacrifice with them, and his spirit is condemned
right.
to protect it.
Right.
And his ghost rises from where the treasure pit, and you have to follow these special rules. And they're really colorful, interesting stories. They're wonderful stories to tell around a campfire. So there's this this grassroots folklore. But later on top of that is the pop culture myth created by somebody like Robert Louis Stevenson, who in the late 19th century, he'd grown up with some of these stories, and then he writes this incredible, skillful, evocative novel, kind of making up a story about pirates burying treasure and sort of intrigue and lore about finding that treasure. And that novel is so successful, it inspires theater and then later an endless cycle of Hollywood movies drawing on his really compelling scenario and characters. And so that all that mixes together to inspire and deceive one generation after another of treasure hunters on a place like Oak Island, where it's a self-sustaining. Since people started digging in the 1790s,
right.
and they've dug in ever more spectacular fashion, there has to be
right.
something there. and so they're all kind of feeding on these myths. And in fact, a lot of the treasure hunting in Oak Island, they've gone past the pirate theories. Go on to other more spectacular theories about conspiracies and imperial expeditions, etc.
Right.
But it all starts with those pirate myths.
Now, before I let you go, there is one man whose name seems to be directly linked to Oak Island. His name is Captain James Anderson. It appears that he actually might have owned a plot of land on Oak Island itself. I'm just kind of curious about him. He seems to have been a privateer. He might have been a turncoat in the Revolution, somebody who was a rebel and turned into a loyalist. Do we know, does he play an important role in sort of the area's piracy history?
Well, Anderson is a loyalist, so these are people who were loyal to the British Crown, and they fled to Nova Scotia after the war, kind
right.
of created a whole community of refugees that helped settle Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Ontario. And many of the loyalists had been privateers, because in the American Revolution, there was an enormous amount of privateering. The American patriots took to it with enthusiasm because they had no significant navy. So there were hundreds and hundreds of American privateer vessels, tens of thousands of American privateer sailors. So every American colonial port sent privateers out to attack the British. And it's kind of, if you were a mariner or a merchant during the American Revolution, it would be surprising if you were not involved in privateering, because there was so much of it in that period. I have not seen a convincing description of Anderson's career. He comes from Baltimore, and apparently he buys and sells some privateer captures, as every merchant in Baltimore would do at that point. Whether he's on an American privateer or not, I've not seen his name appear on a crew list or associated with a specific ship. He appears to ship to New York, which was loyal to the crown and occupied by the British, and that makes him a loyalist. But whether he's a turncoat and switches from an American privateer ship to a British privateer ship, I've not seen convincing evidence of that. He's one of hundreds and hundreds of loyalists who settled the south shore of Nova Scotia,
right.
who've been privateering for the British during the American Revolution. Nothing unusual there. I think the show Oak Island, they found an ancestor who had a sea chest of him, and then they have a chest, an object, that they can kind of pin all kinds of legend to and connect to Oak Island,
right.
and that makes it, a really attractive story to tell. It's certainly true that the Roke Island is settled seriously for the first time by loyalists, who are refugees who fled the American Revolution. And they settle that island and they farm it because it's quite valuable farmland. So there's all kinds of interesting loyalists who end up there. His connection to treachery and treasure to me is not compelling. He's just part of the broader loyalist story.
It certainly doesn't make any sense. He'd bury it 200 feet underground, that's for sure.
No, and if you look at a lot of the privateering in the American Revolution, you're not dealing with vast treasure fleets. You're dealing with people occasionally getting some valuable cargoes that might have stuff like rum and cotton, but often some very petty raids of small-time stuff, none of which
justify
elaborate secret flood tunnels and all the rest of it. There just kind of wasn't that much loot in that colonial economy.
I think if I get one thing out of this conversation, Mr. Conlon, it is that you feel that if you're looking for a theory here, going down the hole of piracy is not the place to go.
Well, if you're looking for a compelling theory with evidence, though, it certainly isn't. you can tell I'm pretty cynical about Oak Island.
Yes.
It's a natural sinkhole that's full of over 200 years of junk from treasure hunters digging into each other's abandoned treasure pits and tools.
Right.
As well as the occasional 18th century farmhouse, because it was a thriving little farming community. But it creates this cycle of treasure hunters exaggerating their finds, and then the next generation of treasure hunters exaggerate the finds even further, and it just creates this self-perpetuating cycle of books and claims and popular culture that will be going on for probably
another 200 years, maybe.
Yeah.
The book is Pirates of the Atlantic: Robbery, Murder, and Mayhem off Canada's East Coast. The author is Dan Conlon. You can get the book. I got it on Amazon. It's beautifully illustrated. It's a great book. Mr. Conlon, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mr. McRae. And fair wind.
Like I said before the interview, Mr. Conlon gave us a lot to think about. For one, he really leans us towards removing pirates from any theory we may have about the origin of the mystery. I'm not sure I'm ready to do that just yet, but as Rick Lagina likes to say on the show, we are close to putting an X through this one, maybe. With any such subject, especially one that deals with pirates, we simply have to separate the myth and legends from the reality of what is possible. And Mr. Conlon kind of really helped us do that, to see more clearly on how pirates have operated over the years. One of the questions I had prepared for him, and I was going to ask if he thought what might have been created, so to speak, underground at Oak Island seemed anything like something a pirate can do or has ever done before. But as you heard, that question just didn't seem very relevant after talking to him for a couple minutes. And before you start inundating me with questions about why I didn't challenge him more on his position that this is all nothing but a sinkhole that's been exaggerated over the centuries, the answer is pretty simple. That's not what we were here to talk about. In my preparations for this interview, my focus was on piracy. I had no idea Mr. Conlon was a skeptic on Oak Island. Mr. Conlon, who himself described his skepticism as cynical, may very well be an expert on the subject of sinkholes in Oak Island, but I don't know that, and I quite frankly never asked him beforehand or ever anticipated needing to do so. Also, there is a time and place to discuss skeptic theories. I just didn't think this was it. It's just way too big a subject for me to kind of start up at the tail end of a conversation about pirates. What I know is that Mr. Conlon has great expertise in maritime history and piracy, and that's what I wanted to talk about. But let's face it, this is a really smart guy whose job is examining the history of Nova Scotia. So his view on this must be respected and should give all the believers some pause and might even open some to the possibility that the mystery around Oak Island is not what you thought or believed it might be. The skeptic's point of view on this is an important one in any study of this subject, and I promise I will do my best to give that view its due in a future episode. And also, As I mentioned earlier in the show, did have some audio issues while recording this. I want to thank my good friend Alan Jax Bowers at Mudcut Studios, who helped me kind of make the best possible podcast here. And he is really an expert on this kind of stuff. He's got a great recording studio there. If you want to learn more about him, Alan Jax Bowers, AlanJaxBowers.com. You can contact him and learn all about what he does there. So thanks, Alan. That will conclude another episode of Digging Oak Island. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Facebook. We are at Digging Oak Island. Give us a like there so you can follow and keep up with the show that way. If you have any questions or comments that you want to send to me directly, you can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. That's at digging, no G at the end of digging, at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. So until next time, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening.